This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
It really is wonderful for you to be listening into Trumpet Hour today. I appreciate that. This is Joel Hilliker. For the last few weeks, I've had the opportunity to be a part of the Celtic Throne tour. We just got back from Little Rock on Monday night. We're preparing for a performance in Tulsa tomorrow night. It has really been a phenomenal experience, very inspiring to be a part of. And for the last word on today's show, I want to share a couple lessons that I have learned from being a part of this project. But before that, we have three stories I think you'll really enjoy and learn a lot from today. First, we're going to talk about U.S. President Joe Biden removing key military infrastructure from the territory of allies in the Middle East, including Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Kuwait, and Jordan. This was quite a stunning announcement, and we're going to look at the ramifications of this decision and what it communicates to these Arab states. We'll hear about this in a report from Trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic. And then we'll talk about vaccines. A prominent physician and a professor of medicine recently called the COVID vaccines the most lethal, toxic biologic agent ever injected into a human body. Now, this is something that the mainstream media don't want to talk about, but there are actually a lot of doctors and scientists coming forward and pointing out enormous health risks, including death, caused by these vaccines. And we're going to have a conversation about this with a man we often turn to on matters of health, personal trainer and holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian. Then we'll talk about archaeology. The Trumpet has a sister website, Watch Jerusalem, that keeps track of the latest discoveries. And we'll hear a report from Watch Jerusalem's archaeology contributor, Chris Eames, on some of the most exciting finds in the first 6 months of 2021 and how there are many of them that relate to and confirm the Bible. So we have a lot to get to today. We're going to start with this announcement about America drawing down its Middle Eastern military presence in this report from Mihailo Zekic.
As part of its withdrawal from the Middle East, the United States is removing major military infrastructure from key allies. Washington is removing 8 Patriot anti-missile batteries from several Arab states, including Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Kuwait, and Jordan. The Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, anti-missile system is also being removed from Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, American jet fighter squadrons in the Middle East are also having their numbers reduced. This all follows U.S. President Joe Biden's announcement of the complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, not including several hundred remaining to protect diplomats and the Kabul airport. The Afghan withdrawal has been a disaster so far. The Taliban, Afghanistan's jihadist insurgent group, is rapidly conquering territory and claims it now controls about 80% of the country. U.S. intelligence estimates that after the withdrawal is complete, Kabul could fall within months. However, the Afghan example apparently hasn't dissuaded Washington from these other hasty withdrawals. Rather than mainly removing troops, the withdrawals from the Arab states entail removing military infrastructure. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and others are American allies. So why is America making it harder for its allies to defend themselves? Analysts assume the purpose for the removals is to redeploy the systems elsewhere, redeploying them to counter China in the Asia-Pacific or to counter Russia in Eastern Europe have been named as potential locations. But America's allies in the Middle East are arguably the most vulnerable to missile attacks. The recent barrage of missiles from Gaza into Israel and the rockets hitting Saudi Arabia from Iraq are testimony to this. Even as America is making allies like Saudi Arabia less secure, however, it's empowering one particular enemy, Iran. Some context. Former United States President Barack Obama made the controversial nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran in 2015. The deal unfroze billions of dollars worth of assets to Iran, the biggest state sponsor of terrorism worldwide. Iran then promised a temporary halting of its nuclear program, which it never actually did. Mr. Obama's successor, U.S. President Donald Trump, left the deal in 2018 and reimposed economic sanctions. Iran has since then openly ramped up its uranium enrichment program. The Biden administration is currently pursuing a new nuclear deal with Tehran, and they're doing everything they can to make Iran happy. Less than 2 months after taking office, Mr. Biden unfroze $3 billion worth of assets for Iran. Earlier this month, America unfroze over $16 million worth of Iranian assets in a South Korean bank, enabling Iran to pay late UN funds and allowing them to take their seat in the UN General Assembly once more. Economic relief was supposed to be America's bargaining chip for halting the nuclear program, but Mr. Biden is giving it away without a deal. American support to Iran goes beyond unfreezing assets, however. Washington is even willing to undermine its allies to appease Iran. For example, the Biden administration pressured the United Arab Emirates to reject a visit from then-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, undermining the Abraham Accords between Israel and the UAE, an agreement Iran opposes. He also pressured Saudi Arabia and the UAE to exit the Yemeni civil war, removing the only major opposition to the Iran-backed Houthi rebels who are taking over the country. These moves by America removed Arabs from Iran's way. But the removal of the anti-missile systems does more. It makes America's Arab allies more vulnerable to Iranian offensives. Here is what analyst George Friedman for Geopolitical Futures wrote regarding the withdrawals. Quote, "There is no obvious explanation for this decision. It is both sudden and sweeping. It does not make defense against Iran impossible, but more difficult. More important, it raises questions in the Arab world about U.S. commitment. Normally, such moves are slow, limited, and designed to calm allies. This one is none of those. Therefore, something important is going on, unless it is simply a clumsy move, which does not reduce its impact. We need to see if these weapons go someplace other than a military base in the United States. If not, the only thing I can think of is Iran." Unquote. When Mr. Trump was in the White House, Washington had an American-first foreign policy. Many accused America under the Trump administration of being isolationist. Mr. Biden came in with a promise to bring America back to international strength. His withdrawals from the Middle East show the exact opposite. These latest developments highlight three Middle Eastern trends that the Trumpet has been watching for years. 1. The rise of Iran. 2. The withdrawal of America. And 3. The moderate Arabs looking for a new ally. These all tie into a biblical prophecy in Daniel chapter 11. It reads this way, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." That's in Daniel 11, verse 40. There are two main characters in this prophecy, the king of the south and the king of the north. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, in his booklet, The King of the South, identifies the King of the South as Iran, leading a region-wide Islamist movement. He identifies the King of the North as a united, powerful Europe. The King of the South is described as having a pushy, provocative foreign policy. The King likes sticking it to world powers that have superior force. This means Iran will rise more and more until the rest of the world can't ignore it. And notice, America isn't even mentioned in this prophecy. It's not even a bystander. Europe is the big fish for Iran. America has had a huge presence in the Middle East for decades, but this prophecy indicates Washington has retreated. Where do the Arabs factor into this? Notice another prophecy in Psalm 83. Keep not you silence, O God. Hold not your peace, and be not still, O God. For lo, your enemies make a tumult, and they that hate you have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people, and consulted against your hidden ones. They have said, Come, and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. For they have consulted together with one consent. They are confederate against you. The tabernacles of Edom and the Ishmaelites, of Moab and the Hagarines, Gebal and Ammon and Amalek, the Philistines with the inhabitants of Tyre. Asser also is joined with them. They have helped the children of Lot. That's in verses 1 to 8. Asser, or Assyria, is modern Germany, the most powerful country in Europe. The King of the South booklet identifies the other peoples mentioned as Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and other Arab countries. Countries like the ones America is abandoning with its latest policies. The moderate Arabs are arguably even more terrified of Iran than the West is. And as in Daniel 11, America is not mentioned as a power player in the Psalm 83 prophecy. That fear of Iran will lead the Arabs to side with Europe, specifically Germany. America may seem to still be a heavyweight in the Middle East, but the latest withdrawals are a forerunner of massive changes in the region. And when these prophecies come to pass fully, they won't stay local issues. They're going to impact the whole world. To learn more, request a free copy of The King of the South, available at thetrumpet.com.
Thank you very much, Mihailo. So this is really very much in line with other policies coming out of the Biden administration that favor Iran. And I guess making all of this even more remarkable is the recent Iranian election, where you have a hardliner now in power, making the extremist nature of Iran's leadership all the more obvious. Not that it was never obvious, but there isn't even a pretense of moderation here.
Oh, of course. And this is probably one of the big impetuses for the Biden administration to bend over backwards and get everything sorted out with Iran. And on June 18th, there were the Iranian presidential elections, and hardliner Ebrahim Raisi was elected. Yeah. That's no surprise. Iranian elections are basically orchestrated by the supreme leader, who has control over foreign policy, nuclear policy anyway. But a big reason that the Obama administration was able to pass on the original nuclear deal was with the election of the current president, Hassan Rouhani, who was portrayed as a moderate, somebody that they could reason with, somebody that's more friendlier with the West, which wasn't true. They started the nuclear negotiations before Rouhani with Ahmadinejad, who was another hardliner. But Rouhani's term ends in August. And a lot of rhetoric coming from Rouhani and his number two man in this regard, Mohammad Javad Zarif, his foreign minister, is talking about, you know, we better conduct the nuclear deal before the new administration comes into power, like while there's still a chance and that kind of thing. And I mean, they're all part of the same government. It's not like you know, one side's trying to negotiate, do something that the other side doesn't want. They're all regardless of whether it's Rouhani or Raisi, they're all basically doing whatever Supreme Leader the Ayatollah wants.
Right.
So, but with this hardliner in power, he's getting a lot of press. For example, talking about how he's going to be a hardcore revolutionist. How there's this one insider to Raisi's campaign who told the media Al Monitor that we're going to get a revolutionary Hezbollah-y kind of government, like Hezbollah and referring to Hezbollah in Lebanon, or where here's another thing the insider told Al Monitor. With this election of Saeed Ebrahim Raisi, we'll see a much more revolutionary Iran than before. So even people within Iran, which never really changes his policies, are saying that Raisi, once he gets into power, he's going to be even more revolutionary than anything Iran's ever seen before. And for whatever reason, even though it's still the same government, still the same supreme leader, the Biden administration is taking this as this is our last chance to get a deal done before the new administration comes in. And because of that, you're seeing Washington do a lot of really, really absolutely irrational and bizarre things in the foreign policy scheme, like unfreezing Iranian assets, pressuring Israel to back off, pressuring the United Arab Emirates to not accept Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu coming to visit, so undermine the Abraham Accords, which is what Iran doesn't like.
It is irrational unless you understand what Gerald Flory has been saying in America Under Attack, and he has a chapter about this in the Great Again booklet, that there is a spiritual dimension to the American foreign policy with respect to Iran that you have to be able to recognize. And it is very much in the context of what he's been saying about 2 Kings 14 verses 26 and 27 and trying to blot out the name of Israel. You see that really on display here in a remarkable way, given what's happening in Iranian politics. And really, Iran seems to be on a bit of a tear in a lot of ways. We had another article on thetrumpet.com from one of our newer writers, Joshua Taylor, on how Iran is turning Iraq into a missile launch pad, essentially. Maybe just talk a little bit about that.
Oh, of course. Well, Iran getting inside Iraq and extending its tentacles over there, that's nothing new. Ever since Saddam Hussein was ousted and with the American withdrawal, a few years after that, Iran has been using their Shiite militias as they're popularly known in the media, to sort of extend control. And Iran has been, for a number of years now, been using Iraq as a and their Shiite militias there as basically a big front for the to attack Saudi Arabia. For example, they have several missiles that are stationed there, like such as Rod 500 missiles that have a range over 300 miles. If launched in certain parts of Iraq, they could reach all the way to Israel. The Zulfaghar missile has a range of about 430 miles, which means it can hit Israel from any part of Iraq or Syria's borders. So Iran has several different infrastructure projects within Iraq, which is, of course, borders Saudi Arabia, which makes all the more reason why Saudi Arabia is losing these defense systems from the states, makes it all the more vulnerable. As America pulls its defense systems out of Saudis and other countries, Iran is putting its own defense or missile systems in countries that border them, which makes it all the more dangerous.
Yeah. Remarkable to watch this unfolding in that region. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic about America withdrawing military installations from Middle Eastern Arab allies. He's written an article about this. It's up at thetrumpet.com. Biden's America is pulling out of the Middle East. Go check it out. Thank you very much for your time, Mihailo.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Dr. Peter McCullough is a professor of medicine and a physician, and he has called COVID vaccines the most lethal, toxic, biologic agent ever injected into a human body. That is a bold statement, but he is not the only health professional challenging the mainstream narrative. The media doesn't want to talk about it, but many doctors and scientists are now coming forward to point out enormous vaccine health risks, including death. To talk about this, we have via Skype from his office in British Columbia, personal trainer and holistic nutritionist, York Mardian. Hello, York.
Hello there.
So let's talk about the safety studies performed on these vaccines. Obviously, there was a big rush to get these out to the public as quickly as possible. What do you know about the safety studies and how thorough they were?
Sure. In last June, Merck Chief Executive Ken Frazier, he stated that vaccines should be tested in large clinical trials that could feasibly take years to complete. His quote was, "You want to make sure that when you put a vaccine into millions, if not billions of people, it's safe." Now, you know, let those words sink in, because the trials were started barely 5 months after this SARS-CoV-2 emerged. And then they were done without proper animal testing or peer-reviewed data. In October 2020, Associate Editor Peter Doshi, he writes in a British medical journal, and he said, "None of the trials currently underway are designed to detect a reduction in any serious outcomes, such as hospital admissions, use of intensive care, or even death." And he said, "Nor are the vaccines being studied to determine whether they can interrupt transmission of the virus." So in other words, you're going to feel a little better with some slight symptom relief, but the vaccines likely won't prevent you from getting COVID or transmitting it to others. And what's even worse is that the long-term phase three human safety studies, they won't be done until 2023. Now think about that. No vaccine based on messenger RNA has ever been approved for any disease or even entered final stage trials until now. So there's no peer-reviewed published human data to compare how this vaccine stacks up against older technologies. And further, you know, despite trying for decades, scientists have never been able to create a successful coronavirus vaccine. So unfortunately, that failure continues to today. And I actually found a paper that showed back in October 2020 that the FDA knew about 21 serious vaccine health issues, including seizures, strokes, myocarditis, autoimmune diseases, a lot of pregnancy, ill health effects, and even death. They knew about this. And certainly their vaccine advisory committee knew about this on December 10th, because they had a meeting when they were authorizing emergency vaccine use. But the acting chairman, Dr. Arnold Monto, he was a former pharmaceutical consultant. He was just busy stifling debate and forcing a vote among the experts present, so there was almost no chance of wording refinement. So in the end, this emergency authorization for these vaccines was granted under highly suspicious circumstances.
So what's in the vaccines? How do these affect the body, from what you have been able to determine?
Sure. The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, they use what's called RNA, which delivers a genetic material into the cells. And the Johnson & Johnson vaccine uses a live virus to carry DNA material. A little bit different each one, but they all work by prompting your own cells to produce the spike protein. So in theory, your immune system learns to recognize and respond quickly to an infection. Well, that's how it works on paper. But the biggest mistake the FDA made is assuming that the spike protein was harmless and that it would remain at the injection site of the shoulder muscles. Now we know for sure, the data shows that it actually gets into the blood and then accumulates in various organs and tissues. And that's actually what causes the bleeding and microclotting and inflammation that leads to death for COVID victims. And we know this from Pfizer's own biodistribution study. In June this year, also, they found more cases of heart inflammation in young adults. I think there was 1,226 cases. That was far more than they expected. And the agency downplayed it by saying, you know, we think these are mostly mild. That is, of course, unless you die from it, which young people do. And I mean, there's so many side effects, we could talk about it all day, but experts do say and summarize, and very credentialed experts, I would say, that these vaccines are going to keep multiplying health problems. And in the future, we're going to see a significant increase in cancer and Parkinson's-like diseases, Huntington's disease, autoimmune, or even neurodegenerative disorders.
It feels like with the media environment being what it is, and even social media, big tech companies are very much on board with this as well. It's hard to get accurate information about what the effects really are and how widespread these problems are that you're describing. What else have you uncovered as you've searched this out?
Well, that is correct. It is hard to get information, very hard. We know the CDC shows that there right now, to this point, there's 6,136 Americans who have died after vaccination. And I think there's 387,000 adverse events, like people going to hospitals, doctors. This is a serious issue. It's devastating, considering that this amount exceeds more than the previous 30 years with 70 vaccines. So I'll give you a comparison. There's 20 to 30 deaths reported every year to the VAERS system related to 175 million flu shots. Okay, that's fairly small. There's still deaths. But if you compare that to the COVID shot, we have over 6,000 deaths through 153 million vaccinations. You know, that's a huge discrepancy, and yet the FDA can't come up with a single death related to vaccines. That's astounding. In Europe, they have 15,472 deaths and 1.5 million injuries. I mean, that's staggering. And that's only for the European Union. That's not for all of Europe. The United Kingdom has 1,356 people that died, Israel 1,700, and Canada, I managed to dig out 119. And all of this information is hidden pretty good. So from those five areas, that's almost 25,000 people that have been killed and injured. And a staggering, I would say conservative, 2.5 million people injured. I mean, it's a horrifying number of deaths and injuries. And the true numbers are certainly far greater. You know, in the U.S., usually there's 50 vaccine deaths that will shut a program down. Yet here, nobody's batting an eye. But that's probably best explained through an investigative report I read, again, from the British Medical Journal, that shows that the CDC receives millions in pharmaceutical industry funding. I also found, interestingly, that the CDC has 57 granted U.S. vaccine patents. You know, and that's worrisome because the CDC should act as an independent watchdog over public health, not like a subsidiary of the pharmaceutical industry. And the World Health Organization appears to be in lockstep with this corruption because their standing vaccination committee has scientists under contract with pharmaceutical companies. And they make, it's a $1 billion industry. So the evidence also suggests that the U.S. government colluded right from the outset with stakeholders such as the Gates Foundation, the CDC, the FDA, the United Nations, and the World Health Organization, pharmaceutical companies, to create a vaccine based on pseudoscience. You know, it was more like a psychological operation of political theater and propaganda to heighten the threat of what I would say was an unremarkable virus to hysterical levels. It was based on fake science and junk data, unreliable testing, terrorization of asymptomatic people, those without illness, and just ignoring a mounting death toll. And that created the need for an unproven vaccine that could, in the end, spell a toll, making the cure far worse than a disease.
All right. Well, we've been talking with personal trainer and holistic nutritionist York Mardian about the health risks associated with COVID vaccines. He's working on an article that should appear soon at thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that. Thank you, as always, for your time, York.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
2021 has been an exciting year in the realm of biblical archaeology. The Trumpet's sister website, watchjerusalem.co.il, works hard to keep up with the latest discoveries, and we'll hear now about a number of fascinating finds that have been uncovered in the first half of 2021 in this report from Watch Jerusalem's archaeology contributor, Chris Eames.
It's quite common for websites like ours to come out at the end of every year with a list of top finds for biblical archaeology. But for the summer segment on the Trumpet Hour, we're going to jump the gun, as it were, and look at some of the biblical archaeology discoveries that have been made so far for the first half of the year. You might be thinking that with COVID, not much progress has been made in the way of archaeology, but that's not entirely true. Already for the first 6 months of the year, we've had several interesting discoveries that have been made or published, so let's crack into them. Firstly, in January, we have the discovery of purple, the discovery of purple fabric in Israel. And that might not seem like much on the surface, but if you know a little bit about the details of this discovery and about biblical fabrics, then this discovery really jumps out. Numerous Bible verses talk about a certain royal color purple called agamon, which was derived from a special type of shellfish. And it was used as a purple dye for the tabernacle, for the temple, for royal clothing. Now, this purple-dyed fabric, these pieces that were discovered, were found at a site called Timnah, and they date to somewhere within the late 11th century to early 10th century BC. And this is exciting because this is precisely in the time frame of Kings David and Solomon. And the Bible talks about the production of purple fabric going on at this very time for Solomon's temple. Not only that, the location of where these fabric pieces were found is notable because Timnah is a copper mining station deep in the Negev Desert in the south of Israel. And the fact that such rich and royal fabric was found in such a remote outpost would indicate that actually there was some wealth in the area, as the Bible describes, of that rich Davidic and Solomonic kingdom, perhaps fine craftsmen that were manning this site instead of a, say, more assumed typical slave force for this type of environment. And then alongside the fabric, the Bible tells us that vast quantities of copper were needed to build the temple. And what did the archaeologists at the Timnah copper mine find alongside this 10th century fabric? Evidence of the slag deposits from this mine show a massive spike in the production of copper at the site during the same 10th century. And the archaeologists also discovered pack animal feed that traces back to Jerusalem, evidently the remains of these pack animals carrying this copper to Jerusalem. So the discovery of the royal purple fabric then goes together beautifully with the biblical account of the Davidic and Solomonic period of wealth, mining operations, and temple building, including the production of this special purple fabric. All right, next up in the month of February, this was quite a special little discovery. It's a small figurine, a few inches high, discovered again in the Negev in the region of Nahal HaBesor. And this was discovered by an 11-year-old boy who was out hiking with his family. And his discovery proved to be a very rare female figurine, believed to date to around the 6th century BC, the Persian period, around the time roughly of Zerubbabel of the Bible. The researchers believe it was probably some kind of fertility figurine or protective amulet. And it's interesting because the biblical prophet Habakkuk, which was on, who was on the scene at the same time, was condemning the people at this time for a reliance on dumb idols, as he called them in Habakkuk 2 verse 18. So this was just a great little discovery that speaks to just how historically rich the land of Israel is, that you can go walking around in the desert and just stumble across a discovery like this from 2,500 years ago. And you can just imagine the excitement for this young 11-year-old boy in doing so. Okay, on to March. This was quite a significant discovery. A new Dead Sea Scroll that was found. The first one discovered in 60 years. This scroll was discovered in the rugged Dead Sea region inside a cliff-edge cave known as the Cave of Horrors, which it had been called that as it was a Jewish hideout some 2,000 years ago, and the bodies of those Jews were found in the cave a few decades ago. Now, the scroll fragments that were discovered from this time, they turned out to be a copy of the Minor Prophets section of the Bible, and they contained passages from the books specifically of Zechariah and Nahum. Besides these scroll fragments, the archaeologists in the area also discovered the mummified body of a child and several other finds from surrounding caves, including the world's oldest basket from the Neolithic period, coins, weapons, clothing, and etc. Finally, another little item for the month of March. This was discovered in Greece. It was a rare bronze bull idol, a sort of statuette that served as a sacrificial object for the god Zeus. It was found at the site of Olympia, and it dates to roughly around 800 BC. Now, from a biblical perspective, what is interesting to note about this is the connection the god Zeus and his bull worship had to the famous pagan god of the Bible, Baal. Zeus is actually the Greek equivalent of the Canaanite Baal of the Bible, and Zeus would sometimes be called Zeus Baal. Now, both gods were bull-related deities, both were seen as thunder gods, and in artwork, both gods were depicted as holding a lightning bolt in their hand as their sort of symbol. And I think it's really interesting to note that around this same time as you have these bulls and bull idols being offered to Zeus in Greece, you have that famous parallel biblical account of the prophet Elijah and the 450 priests of Baal, and that test on Mount Carmel to see which is the true God. And as 1 Kings chapter 18 describes, the priests of Baal cried out for him to light their bull sacrifice on fire, but to no avail. But then Elijah's prayer was answered by a literal bolt of fire from heaven, and it's like the symbolism of a bolt of fire coming down. It wouldn't have been lost on the pagan priests of Baal and the Israelites there. After all, it was their God that was supposed to have been able to launch bolts of fire from heaven. So again, an interesting little bull idol discovery here dedicated to Zeus, paralleling the kind of pagan bull-related Baal worship going on in the not too far away Israel. Okay, on to April, the month of April. There were a few for this month. This was the month that Dr. Elat Mazar revealed her new research about the design of a massive four-way staircase in Jerusalem at the time of King Herod and his Second Temple. She also revealed for the first time a discovery that had been tucked away from her grandfather's excavations, a miniature 2,000-year-old gold ring with a menorah image incised on it. And we won't go into any more detail about those since we discussed them on an earlier Trumpet Hour segment. Another especially significant discovery revealed in April was the earliest alphabetic inscription ever found in Israel. This was an inked pottery piece found at Lachish, a city southwest of Jerusalem, and it dates to the 15th century BC, nearly 3,500 years ago. The inscription is pretty fragmentary. We don't really know what it says. Perhaps it contains the words slave and honey on it. But what is really significant about this is that it fills a gap in the record of the alphabet. Now, you and I use an alphabetic system in the way we read and write. In fact, it's the most used writing system on the planet. The early Hebrews were among the first to use this system, and there's strong indication that they were even the ones who invented it. And you can read about that on our website, watchjerusalem.co.il. Just type in the word alphabet into the search bar. Now, the very earliest alphabetic inscriptions ever found were discovered in the Sinai Peninsula and in Egypt. And these date to a couple centuries earlier, perhaps around the 18th century BC. And they belonged to Semitic individuals who served as slaves for the Egyptians. And this fits with the enslaved Israelites of the Bible. But until now, for the nation of Israel, the earliest confirmed use of the alphabetic script in Israel dated to the 13th century BC, so about half a millennium later. So there was this gap of several centuries of uncertainty as to how this script came across to first be used in Israel. But with this new discovery, we now see that the use of the script in the Holy Land can be found as far back as the 15th century BC, which also happens to be the same century that Israel entered the Promised Land. So was this then perhaps the Israelites effectively bringing their alphabet with them? It could have been the case, and a new publication is coming out, I believe, by Dr. Douglas Petrovic, showing that stylistically this is indeed specifically an Israelite, a Hebrew inscription. So an early interesting artifact there. Next up, we have a pretty interesting discovery made in Italy, in Isernia. I believe that's in central Italy, made in the month of April again. Italian archaeologists discovered a beautifully sculpted marble head belonging to Rome's very first Caesar, Augustus. Now, Augustus began his reign on January the 16th, 27 BC, a date that I think many of our longtime listeners will find interesting. Augustus is mentioned in the Bible in Luke chapter 2 as being the one responsible for ordering a census, which meant that Joseph and Mary needed to make the trip down to Bethlehem. And the discovery of this head was made during this head of Augustus. It was made during repair work to a damaged section of walls of the Via Occidentale, which had collapsed. And I think this is a rather interesting tidbit as well. One of the archaeologists noted that the walls obscuring this discovery had collapsed during a violent storm, quote, on the very night Pope Francis was elected, unquote. So that incident ultimately led to this revealing of the first head of the Roman Empire, quite literally. All right, next up we have a couple items for the month of May. The first is a preliminary research analysis by underwater archaeologist Dr. Sean Kingsley. And Kingsley believes he has found evidence of King Solomon's maritime trade empire all the way across the Mediterranean into Spain. He cites the biblical account of Solomon's import of various goods via Phoenician merchants, especially silver. You'll note that the Bible talks about Solomon making silver in Israel more common than stones, or at least silver in Jerusalem more common than the stones on the ground. And Kingsley believes that much of the silver was mined in Spain, which he theorizes is the biblical area of Tarshish. Along the way to the location, there's an island called Tafet, which is the name of one of Solomon's daughters. He notes the island of Sardinia, on which an early inscription was discovered, mentioning the presence of Phoenicians. He then cites material evidence, including DNA samples taken from excavations in southern Spain, that show that early Phoenicians were all over the place there. Inland from the southern Spanish coast, there's a mine called Rio Tinto, and it's the biggest mine in antiquity. And during this early Iron Age period, Phoenician remains can be found at the mine, including Phoenician pottery with silver fused to it, and tools for processing the metal. There's also a nearby hill that the Spanish used to call the Hill of Solomon. Kingsley then proposes that the silver was taken downriver to a station at the coast called Huelva, but it was called by the ancient Greeks Tartessos, and he believes that this is the biblical Tarshish. The use of this site, he notes, dates to around the time of King Solomon. And at this site, they found furnaces and molds for processing silver, alongside really a ton of Phoenician pottery and general goods from the Levant, including shipbuilding parts from the same 10th century BC as King Solomon. So some really tantalizing stuff there from Dr. Kingsley, pointing to Solomon's silver imports. And he also reveals the discovery of a submerged 10th century ship on the coast of Dor, Israel. And the Bible says that this site was one of Solomon's administrative centers. Moving along, another discovery for May. This again was a research paper published by scientists at the University of Western Australia, and they were researching a type of ancient monument found scattered throughout Saudi Arabia called mustatils. These are long, low-walled stone rectangle structures that are scattered across the Saudi desert and even up the side of some volcanoes in Saudi Arabia. And the researchers helped to prove that they were part of an ancient cattle cult. The researchers dated them to the 6th millennium BC, and they called it the, quote, first large-scale monumental ritual landscape anywhere in the world, the earliest evidence for cattle cult in the Arabian Peninsula, end of quote. So for students of the Bible, this is all very interesting because the earliest hint of an established pagan worship in the Bible is linked to cattle. Genesis 4 verse 20 says that Jabal, a descendant of Cain, was, quote, the father of such as dwell in tents and cattle. But the Hebrew word tents here is also the same word used for the tabernacle and for other ritual establishments. And given the wider negative context of this passage, the scripture is actually interpreted as the first record of instituted pagan worship, and at that with a connection to cattle. Early Jewish commentaries going back nearly 2,000 years describe Jabal as the, quote, first among men to erect temples to idols. And that's what we see here in Saudi Arabia, as the researchers call it, the quote again, first large-scale monumental ritual landscape anywhere in the world, the earliest evidence for a cattle cult. Even the fact that a few of these mustatils were placed around volcano vents is interesting, because Jabal's own brother, Tubal-Cain, is directly linked to volcanoes. And it's apparently from his name, pronounced Tubal-Cain, that we get our word volcano. And it also makes sense for these establishments built by Cain's descendants to be found in Saudi Arabia, since this territory has been often identified as being the land of Nod, to which his family was banished. So this new research then provides interesting evidence looking right back at the earliest Bible history. Finally, for the month of June, archaeologists working at the Philistine city of Gath published research about the fall of the city around 800 BC. Arrowhead remains discovered at the site show that things got so desperate in the city that the defenders evidently started to make arrowheads out of animal bones. Now, this discovery helps illuminate the biblical account, which speaks of two destructions of Gath around this time that it may relate to. One was at the hand of Syria's King Hazael, and that's mentioned in 1 Kings 12. And then the other is at the hand of Judah's King Uzziah, and that's mentioned in 2 Chronicles 26. Well, that covers some of the significant archaeological discoveries just for the first half of this year. So we look forward to what the rest of the year has to reveal. Stay tuned to watchjerusalem.co.il for all the most important archaeological discoveries.
It's time for today's last word.
Well, the Celtic Throne Tour is nearing its conclusion. We've had a tour of 11 shows. 9 of them are finished. We had 2 shows in Edmond, 1 in Dallas. We visited Austin, Amarillo, Birmingham, Nashville, Memphis, Little Rock this past Monday. And we have just a couple shows remaining. But it's been really inspiring to see how the audiences are responding to this show. I have kind of a hobby that I've developed as we've been performing, because I'm standing on the bandstand. I'm playing the Irish drum and the mandolin during these performances. And I can look out and kind of see the faces of the audiences that we've been playing to. And I'll just kind of find, maybe pick out a few faces of a few audience members that look kind of reticent and dubious at the beginning of the show, and then just track how they respond over the course of the show. And almost invariably, by the end of the show, they're smiling, they're clapping enthusiastically, they're really into it. So it's just been exciting to see the responses that we've been getting from people. But I just want to share a couple of lessons that I've learned from being a part of this production. There is a scriptural principle in Acts 20 and verse 35. It says, "Remember the words of the Lord Jesus, how he said, 'It is more blessed to give than to receive.'" And God's way of life really is the way of give. But one thing that Celtic Throne has taught me is that really giving to others requires expending a tremendous amount of energy. These kids that are dancing on the show, and really all of us that are involved in this production, have to pour all of our effort into the performances. No one is interested in a half-hearted performance. The audience really enjoys it when those who are on stage are going all out. And I've just been thinking about what a tremendous life lesson this is. It's just such a valuable truth that you can't truly live the way of give by just giving a half-hearted effort in whatever it is that you're doing. We really need to put a lot of energy into our life, into our work, in our conversations, our relationships, those with our friends and our family, everything that we do. As Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10 says, "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might." And it says the reason for that is you don't live long. Life is short. You only have so much time. So don't waste it. Make the very most of it. Don't sleepwalk through life or be half-hearted or passive or sit around and just wait for opportunities to land in your lap. Seize the day. Push yourself. You know, make the most of every opportunity. And when an opportunity comes, grab hold of it and give it all you have. Colossians 3 and verse 23 in the New International says, "Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord." It's such an important thing to remember, because we all get too comfortable in our little ruts and fail to put real energy into life. And that's just not the way that God wants us to live. He doesn't want us to be half-hearted. He wants wholehearted energy. Living with energy and effort and enthusiasm and real joy. That is what the way of give is all about. And it's a tremendous lesson from Celtic Throne. I've been talking with some of the dancers, my own children and the other dancers in the show, about just how important this is for that show to really be successful. You've got to go all in, and it's true in everything in life. And you do have to bring that energy regardless of what the audience does. Sometimes they're really into it, and sometimes maybe they're just kind of sitting back and waiting to receive more. And that's true in a lot of social situations as well. Whatever situation you're in, it goes a lot better if you really put your effort into it. The Apostle Paul wrote in Romans 12, "Let love be without dissimulation or without hypocrisy. Abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good." So he's talking about wholehearted love. He's talking about abhorring and cleaving, which are very active words going all the way. He says in verse 10, "Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another, loving each other like a family should." He says in verse 11, "Don't be slothful in business," or tardy, lazy, sluggish. You have to fight this tendency all the time, but be fervent in spirit, boiling hot, serving the Lord. And he talks about the verses 12 and 13, rejoicing in hope, continuing instant in prayer, distributing to the necessity of saints, given to hospitality. It's just living the give way and being wholehearted about it. It's a really important lesson that you see throughout the Bible. And if you're doing that, you're always going to receive better results in everything that you do. And a second lesson that's kind of tied in with this is that it's always more fun with family. This has been such a wonderful opportunity, and I've thoroughly enjoyed the time with the people that have been contributing to this. It's just it's great to be a part of a lot of people working together to do something epic together. It's a lot of fun. I think it translates really well on the stage. There is a lot in the show that where we're just interacting with one another on the stage, and we don't have to fake it. We really are genuinely enjoying the opportunity to do this together. It's a lot of fun. And it's just been striking me what a very special group of people there that we have working on this. And we're drawing closer together the more we work together. And it's really a microcosm of what God is doing through his whole church and even beyond that. This is the way it works with God, and this is the way it's going to work forever. I think back to the prehistory in the Bible where it's just God and the Word, and they're doing amazing things, but they wanted family to share it all with. And that's really the basis of God's entire master plan. We've been hearing from Gerald Fleury, our editor-in-chief, recently about Emmanuel and how that means God with us. And this really shows how everything God does reinforces this lesson of family and how God just wants to be with his family. He wants to work together with us, and he wants to accomplish amazing things being right there together with his family. And that's really been an outstanding lesson from participating in this that has stood out in my mind. Well, these are just two of many wonderful lessons that I've learned from being a part of this show, and it's just reinforced in my mind what a blessing it is to be a part of the work of God, to be co-workers with the great loving God and Father of the universe. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Mihailo Zekic, Jorg Mardian, and Chris Eames. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Ralph Waldo Emerson. Write it on your heart that every day is the best day in the year. He is rich who owns the day. And no one owns the day who allows it to be invaded with fret and anxiety. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.